Gluten may not be the most appetizing sounding word, but it is a basic ingredient in much of the food that we eat. For those who have celiac disease, a gluten-free diet is a necessity, and many people feel that a diet without gluten is helpful for other reasons as well. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about gluten, and joining us are Chef Dean J. Livornia, Department Chair of the Baking and Pastry Department at the Johnson & Wales University College of Culinary Arts in Providence, Rhode Island, and nutritionist Bernadette Latson, an assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Nutrition at the University of Texas's Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
And we invite our listener calls at 646-829-3985, or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So let's begin with you, Dean. What role does gluten play in foods? Is it just a coincidence that it starts with glue?
Well, gluten is considered the backbone of baked goods. It gives the structure and the strength to baked goods. So the fact that it's called gluten probably hundreds of years ago, when somebody had the bright idea to not only mill flour but mix it with water, it turned into this gluey substance. So that's the only way that I can see that relationship there between glue and gluten was way back when, when they started first mixing it together. It looked gluey. But it is a protein. Gluten is a protein that's found in large quantities in wheat, in smaller quantities in barley and rye as well.
So it's only in grains?
It is in grains, yes.
Are there any grains that are gluten-free?
There are plenty of gluten-free grains, and when we do baking and cooking for celiac individuals, we use a lot of different types of grains. Quinoa is a grain that's great for gluten-free. There are rice flours, white rice flour, brown rice flour, garbanzo bean flour. I mean, there's all kinds of different grains that do not contain that protein called gluten.
But gluten is used in many things. Not just bread as a basic component, and it's often put into foods as an additive. Why?
For structure. So it depends on the food and the manufacturer. A gluten, vital wheat gluten, which is, just the straight-up structure building property is added and can be added to a lot of vegetarian or vegan types of food, because when they're removing the proteins of meat, they still want that texture of protein. So in a lot of those types of foods...
like in chili.
In chili, they'll add that textured, for the texture, because it does simulate a meaty kind of texture.
Bernadette, we've established that gluten is a protein in grains.
Right.
What's its chemical makeup?
It's a fairly large storage protein. That's kind of its function in the grains. And... So gliadin, it's a specific peptide fraction or a little group of proteins that are found together in the wheat, rye, and barley. And wheat is what we usually hear about.
There are different names for the glutens in wheat, rye, and barley, aren't there?
There are. Many people might have heard of gliadin and glutenin, and those are the offending peptides in the wheat. And then in rye, there's a protein that has a similar function. It's called sacchalin.
Is it the same as the wheat peptides, or are there differences?
There are some differences, but it is also typically toxic to people with celiac disease. And then in barley, the protein is called hordeon. And they are the peptides. They're the proteins that resist complete digestion, and so their interaction with the immune system helps to trigger that inflammatory response that people suffer from who have celiac disease.
I understand that about 1% of the American population has celiac disease. How many people is that? Do we know?
1 in 100.
Uh-huh. So it is
about 1 in 133, I guess, is what the study's saying.
Right.
So it's a lot of people, but not all that many people. When you see just how many packages say gluten free these days,
right. It is a lot of people, and it's even higher in people of certain origins, like those of Northern European origin in the U.S. since it's a genetically based disease. So some pockets of the population have a higher prevalence. But, It is certainly a very popular food category nowadays. People say it's one of the new fads.
It seems as though we're hearing more about gluten and gluten-free diets. Is celiac disease on the increase?
We believe that the diagnosis of celiac disease is definitely increased, and that's a good thing because people need to know if they have it. And especially in adults, the diagnosis of celiac disease has really increased as awareness has increased, and that's a wonderful thing.
Dean, what does gluten-free really mean? Can gluten be completely removed from one's diet?
Gluten-free does mean that the gluten is removed. You need to be careful of, there's a difference between wheat-free and gluten-free, so when you see packaging that says wheat-free, it isn't necessarily gluten-free.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things you need to read the packaging. So gluten can be completely removed, and it's not as difficult as you might think. I mean, somebody gets diagnosed with celiac, and I know this firsthand. My wife has celiac, and my two children do as well. So you think, you know, I'm a pastry chef. They get diagnosed with celiac, you know, life is over. There's no more cookies. There's no more breads. There's no more cakes. There's no more pastries. It takes a little bit more creativity and exploration of alternative ingredients, but you certainly can remove the gluten completely from the diet. I mean, it's a necessity to do so for somebody that suffers from celiac.
I know a couple where the woman who has celiac disease insists that her husband use a separate toaster.
Mm-hmm.
Are those sorts of precautions absolutely necessary?
Yes, there is cross-contamination that can occur, and that's why it's difficult for people that suffer with celiac disease to actually go out into the general marketplace and dine at restaurants. Even if they're saying that they have gluten-free menus, we're relying on the training that's been done of the kitchen staff to say that if I use this fryolator to deep fry these beer-battered onion rings, I cannot turn around then and submerge these gluten-free breaded onion rings into that same oil.
My guests are Dean J. Livornia, the department chair of the Baking and Pastry Department at the Johnson & Wales University College of Culinary Arts in Providence, Rhode Island, and the husband of a woman who has celiac disease and a father of some children who do as well. So he really has thought a lot about gluten-free diets. And nutritionist Bernadette Latson, an assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Nutrition at the University of Texas's Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and in a few moments we'll be taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Bernadette, I want to get back to something you said, that celiac disease is a genetic condition that has highest percentages in populations of certain origins like Northern Europeans. So are there any evolutionary theories as to why it has developed in those populations? Is there anything positive about celiac disease? There are some other illnesses that have developed in response to other conditions.
I'm not sure if there's anything positive about it. It is pretty challenging. Dean's family is very lucky to have an expert chef prepare food for them. And something that people can do as well to help cope with the condition is to enlist the help of a registered dietitian to help them plan their meals and make sure that they're well, that they're nutritionally balanced, even in the with the restriction of following a gluten-free diet.
Can you explain what celiac disease is and how it develops?
Well, as I said, it is a genetically based disease, and it's triggered in response to gluten. And most of us can eat gluten our whole lives and not have any. It doesn't cause the disease. Gluten does not cause the disease itself, but it is the trigger for the inflammatory response that affects the intestinal mucosa, that affects the gastrointestinal tract, and also triggers an immune response in a more general way, and can lead to many other serious medical problems.
And I understand that in some extreme cases it can also be fatal.
Well, certainly some of the resulting conditions, the most serious of which would be lymphomas, is related to not following, a gluten-free diet for somebody who has celiac disease. And that's why it's so important to have it diagnosed and to be quite strict about the diet if one does have it.
Dane, is a gluten-free diet especially difficult for children who seem naturally, at least in the United States, to lean toward what doctors call the bland white diet, bread of all kinds, pasta, cookies, and so on?
Yes, and we had some experience with that. We determined probably around 10, when my daughter was 10, she was complaining of stomach aches, stomach issues. We thought something was going on at school. We knew my wife had a sensitivity at that point to gluten. We weren't sure it was celiac or not, but we decided to take her off of the white gluten, the wheat gluten. And within a week or two, her stomach aches cleared up. So we knew there was something going on there. But we look at their school lunches. It's that white bread with peanut butter and jelly. It's the cookies or the crackers or, the goldfish. Those are the things that we put in our kids' lunch.
Now, Bernadette, Dean mentioned that his wife seemed to have gluten sensitivity. Haven't doctors tended to dismiss that notion in the past, that there's something that isn't celiac but could still be gluten sensitivity?
Well, I think at UT Southwestern, the doctors would take any of those complaints of their patients very seriously and really try to address them. And while gluten sensitivity is not a specifically diagnosed disease because there isn't a specific diagnostic test, I think that I know, in fact, that the doctors here and the clinicians would really help people to address that if that's what they wanted to do. If somebody just like Dean's daughter wanted to try that, I think they would definitely be supportive of it. And, people do want to try that, and it is getting easier to do it because of the wide availability of the foods.
Well, there are negative aspects to a gluten-free diet, aren't there? You can have vitamin deficiencies, especially B12 and iron and vitamin D.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And certainly, I know here at UT Southwestern, we do not recommend gluten-free diets for all, and because there are consequences, and that's why it's important, if at all possible, to have it diagnosed. But in the case of gluten sensitivity, it may not be diagnosable at that point. But yes, I mean, there are certainly risks, and I would not recommend that somebody begin to follow a restrictive diet that leaves out a lot of important foods. As you said, there's iron deficiency, B vitamin deficiencies, and both of those can affect your how you think, your cognitive function. They can lead to anemias, which are, which is a serious condition. And many people with longstanding celiac disease get osteoporosis from vitamin D and calcium deficiency. And basically what happens is that the inflammatory response damages the intestinal mucosa so that you can end up malabsorbing a lot of different nutrients. So there's a wide range of malabsorption associated with it, but then on the other hand, leaving out a lot of different foods that are perhaps like flour is usually enriched with B vitamins and iron, and when you're buying a specialized gluten-free flour, it may not be, or you may be avoiding it altogether.
Well, some people think that gluten-free diets are good for losing weight. Are they?
Only in the sense that one might have to eliminate a lot of foods. But generally, no. Gluten-free diets are specific, and they're not a one-size-fits-all.
And, Dean, how do you go about making sure that the gluten-free diets in your family are balanced well? Is this like being a vegetarian? You have to be quite active in making choices and be conscious about the substitutions that you make?
Yes.
What kinds of things do you do?
You constantly read labels anyway. So you pick up something off the grocery shelf, you read it, make sure that it's safe, first of all. And then I'm always looking at carbohydrates and sugars and fats, just like I would with any type of diet on a daily basis. We do a lot of fruits and vegetables, but there are some really great pasta products. We had pizza last night, using a white rice flour pizza crust, which is totally acceptable.
Does it taste just as good, or is it an acceptable?
It's acceptable. It tastes, it's gluten-free. The drawback to us is our kids have experienced the quote-unquote real things, so it's been hard to go backwards because the gluten-free products are just not the same as that wheat gluten product. They're good in and of themselves. They're good. But if you're thinking, wow, I really wish I could have the cinnamon roll like I used to have, you know, you've got to make allowances when you've been diagnosed and you want to eat healthier and you want to be healthy. There are certain allowances you have to make.
Although if it prevents people from eating those cinnamons, maybe that's a good thing. My guess
is you might lose weight as a result.
I do make a mean gluten-free cinnamon roll. I will tell you that.
We'll take a short break and then take some calls from our listeners. Our number is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Chef Dean J. Lavornia, Department Chair of the Baking and Pastry Department at the Johnson & Wales University College of Culinary Arts in Providence, Rhode Island, and nutritionist Bernadette Latson, an assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Nutrition at the University of Texas's Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. We're back with our Please Explain look at gluten and gluten-free diets with nutritionist Bernadette Latson and Chef Dean J. Lavornia. Our number 646-829-3985. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Catherine in Brooklyn writes, even though many grains are gluten-free, they are processed in facilities where wheat is processed. How can we be sure whether they have not been contaminated?
The packaging has to say gluten-free. So there's got to be some kind of a gluten-free stamp or gluten-free logo of some kind on there, which tells the person who's buying it that this facility has been inspected and that ingredient is not processed in a plant that processes wheat ingredients.
Look, go ahead, Bernadette.
And yes, I agree. And Dean commented on that earlier when he was talking about deep frying and the risks of cross-contamination. So certainly it is one of the challenges of having celiac disease.
Karen from Chatham, New Jersey is on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is, if there has ever been truly a connection made between gluten and inflammatory diseases such as arthritis. My daughter was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis last year, and in an effort to complement the medication that she's on and, make a change dietarily, we put her on a gluten-free diet, and also the whole family did. She and I noticed a difference regarding sleeping better, feeling better, thinking better, regarding inflammation. There's a little bit of a difference. We're still kind of not sure because she's been on so much medication, but I was wondering if any research has been done about that.
Well, there certainly is a connection between all of the different autoimmune diseases, and juvenile arthritis is an autoimmune disease, and so is celiac disease, and there's a higher prevalence, of course, of them overlapping along with some of the other inflammatory diseases. Exactly what the connection is, I think, has not been teased out, but, for example, people with celiac disease do have a higher risk for getting other autoimmune diseases and probably vice versa.
Okay.
So I'm glad it helped.
Yeah, a little bit.
Thank you so much for your call. We have a lot of people writing in. Amanda says, I wondered if the rise in gluten sensitivity has been connected to the increase in genetically modified foods on the shelves, especially since foods do not indicate whether or not they have GMOs in them. Could that be, or do they have nothing to do with gluten?
I don't know of any connection there. I don't know either.
Okay. We go now to Robin from Teaneck, New Jersey. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was diagnosed a little over a year ago with celiac disease. I'm 56 years old. And my doctor said, if you get the diagnosis, go straight to Columbia University. They have a celiac center, and meet with the nutritionist, which I did. She was very helpful. And she made the comment that when she bakes, she uses oat flour. She doesn't use any combinations of the gluten-free mixes that are suggested, just oat flour. Mm-hmm. So I have been following that pattern, but I am not a particularly creative or experimental baker, and so I've been hesitant to just use the oat flour when it recommends a whole combination. And so I'm wondering if that's possible to do, and I also never see oat flour mentioned, nor did you mention it at the beginning of the show.
I think, yeah, Dean can certainly address the baking aspects of it. Oats is one of the controversial areas because traditionally we did feel that it should be avoided with celiac disease. More recently, fortunately, there's been quite a bit of oats available in the North American market that is, you know, that is safe for people to eat in limited amounts. It should be marked accordingly. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of, you know, getting it off the shelf.
Right.
And so it should specifically say that it's, you know, that it's not contaminated and that sort of thing. And about 50 grams a day is feasible for many people who have celiac disease. However, I will say that there are others who are also sensitive to the avidin storage protein in oatmeal.
Right.
So I guess you would have to proceed with caution.
Yeah, no, that doesn't seem to be a problem. In fact, I eat gluten-free oatmeal every morning. And
wonderful.
But it's more, I was wondering, I guess, for the texture when you bake,
texture,
can you use just oat flour?
I would certainly encourage you to come up with a flour blend that works for you. You know, it takes a little bit of experimentation. Well, it takes a lot of experimentation. But there are blends that you can make of your own. If you look at a gluten-free flour blend in the store, just turn it around and see what types of flours they have in it. Every blend is going to give you a different texture on the finished product. So what works for me in a cookie, the blend that I use in a cookie is not necessarily going to work in an Angel Food cake and vice versa. So it takes some experimentation to say, you know, I need this percentage of high-protein flour, which could be a garbanzo or a fava or a soy flour. And then I'm looking for something that, you know, is a little more starchy, like a corn starch, a potato starch, a tapioca starch. So there's a lot of different types of flours and starches that you can use to simulate that elasticity and that the gluten has, you know.
Thank you for calling us, Robin. Tom in Brooklyn asks, I've heard that using a truly wild sourdough culture to make bread can make it digestible for celiac sufferers. Is that true?
I have not heard that. The starter, the sourdough starter for breads, still contains wheat flour.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had any experience with that.
I guess the suggestion there is that the chemical process it goes through winds up changing it and taking the gluten out. But
that's possible.
Others have asked about alcohol, vinegars, lipstick. Do they all have gluten in them?
They may have. Distilled vinegar does not, but malt vinegar, the kind that they like to serve with the fish and chips in England, the malt vinegar, yes.
Because malt has it?
Yes, malt. Anything that says malt, like a malted milkshake, that is usually comes from barley, and barley does contain a protein that is not tolerated.
What about lipstick, Mary Beth questions? Do you know about that?
I have heard that cosmetics may have, they may have some gluten in them. I don't know of any. There are probably specific brands that do say gluten-free.
Yeah. You can go on to any search engine on your computer, and you just type in gluten-free lipsticks, and a whole bunch of stuff will come up, or gluten-free eye makeup, or gluten-free anything that you're looking for, gluten-free alcohol, gluten-free spirit.
Gluten-free talk shows.
Gluten-free talk shows. A whole bunch of stuff will come up.
Heather, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about gluten-free baking. My 7-year-old daughter is in the process of being diagnosed with celiac, and she has numerous multiple food allergies, including to egg. And I've noticed that a lot of the gluten-free products seem to increase the amount of egg in the baking to make up for the lack of the gluten. I'm wondering if there are recommendations for egg substitutes when you're doing gluten-free baking.
There are vegan-friendly egg replacers that you can find that are made up of starches and gums to simulate, again, eggs are a protein. The egg white is a protein, structure building. So this is why they increase the egg content when they're decreasing or getting rid of that wheat flour content. So they're looking for some kind of a structure building property. So there are vegan egg products out there that can be added to baked goods in place of eggs. You can use tofu, silken tofu, blended into a batter or dough to replace eggs as well in some instances.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good.
Penny from Manhattan, you're on the air. Oh, no. Yeah, Penny, is it? I'm sorry, from Metuchen.
Penny from Metuchen, not Manhattan.
Yeah, well, from heaven anyway, Penny.
It's Penny. I don't know whether I've got a gluten sensitivity. If I have a sandwich at lunchtime, I can't have bread or pasta in the evenings because I get indigestion. And this has happened over the past couple of years. Does gluten sensitivity progress? Does it get worse and worse? And is it sort of dangerous? Because I don't really want to go to the doctor for a diagnosis because my insurance is lousy.
But and I want to add to this because a number of listeners have written in saying that they have tested negative for celiac, but that they feel that they are gluten sensitive.
Well, it's certainly worth a trial if people are gluten sensitive and to see if that improves the symptoms if they've already been tested negative for celiac disease. That's the direction that I would go. And there's just such good information out there, and you can get guidance from so many sources that I think being quite strict about it for a limited period of time and then evaluating that yourself could work.
Mm-hmm. I find if you're eating something and you're finding you're feeling not so great after you've eaten it, stop eating it. I mean, that's pretty much what it, well, you know, if you feel you've had pasta, you've had a sandwich, and you feel lousy, you have indigestion, you have bloating, you have diarrhea, assess what you've eaten the meal before or the day before and try to avoid those foods for a little while and see if you feel better. If you feel better, whether you're diagnosed with anything or not, don't eat it.
That's how people discover that they're lactose intolerant as well.
Right. And I think that celiac has been misdiagnosed for a long time because of that lactose intolerant issue. I had people all the time coming to me saying, you know, I used to love to eat pizza, and I realized I was lactose intolerant. It wasn't the cheese that was on the pizza. It was the dough that was holding the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't lactose intolerant. They were celiac. You know, so they found out later on, years later, because they were misdiagnosed as lactose intolerant.
Let's go to another caller. Carolyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just so excited that you're addressing this issue. I just got diagnosed last week with celiac, and I happened to be listening to the show, and I just have so many questions, I don't even know where to start.
Well, try to limit yourself, because we have a lot of calls.
I know.
You're not alone.
I was very excited to hear that we have a baker who is successful in baking. It's one of the things I really love to do, and I'm so sad that I can't bake pies or cookies.
Oh, but you can.
I want to figure out how to do it. Do you have a cookbook?
I'm working on one, to be honest with you. I am working on one.
But there are cookbooks out there that are already addressing these issues.
Yes, there are some out there.
And are there any that you think are really good, Dean?
That's why I'm writing one.
Because
through our years of trying to do things, I've got a number of books that just none of them really, I feel, are that great.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Carolyn, this is really an opportunity for somebody who loves to cook. It's much harder for somebody who eats out all the time.
Well, I actually was relieved that I got this diagnosis because this is something that I can control and I can fix.
Absolutely.
You know,
that's a very positive way to look at it.
Yeah,
because
I mean,
they had a lot of other things going on that could have been the problem, and that would have meant, like, surgery and all sorts of stuff.
Right.
I'm excited to try to change things. It's going to be hard for my family, though. I mean, do I have to cook two meals now, or do I make them change? I mean, I am going to get my kids tested. I was listening to your other caller about her daughter's autoimmune disease. My child has an autoimmune arthritis, and I'm wondering whether he actually has celiac.
They should be tested as well.
Exactly.
First-degree
yeah.
relatives do have a higher chance of that, but you will just have to keep some of your food separately, especially when you cook at home, so that your food doesn't get contaminated with theirs.
If you are going to eat out, a listener points out that Australia is a gluten-free paradise. Every menu indicates what's gluten-free.
Wow.
And there are other cultures where the traditions deal with these. A listener left this comment on our show page. There are traditions that we've forgotten about of treating grains to neutralize the difficulty they present to our digestive systems. Lime water soaking for corn in Latin America, lemon, yogurt, whey-soaking oats and pulses, and, of course, making sourdough bread. Food traditionalists say it's the latest industrial methods that speed up bread making that are the culprits for the ubiquity of celiac and other digestion issues. What do you say, Bernadette? Do you agree with that 100%?
I don't think we're quite there yet to treat celiac disease by treating the peptides, but I do think that is the future, that will be one of the future treatments for celiac disease, where the specific groups of peptides can take an enzyme that will break them down. But we are definitely not there yet, I would say, as far as changing the food to make it safe. So I think Carolyn's solution is the best. Just embrace it and be quite strict about avoiding it if one does have celiac disease.
Betsy asks, could gluten be behind my 20-year-old son's inability to gain weight even though he tested negative for celiac disease?
Well, there are a wide variety of reasons why somebody is not able to gain weight. I would say one of the first things right there is that he's quite young. Just wait till middle age arrives.
Yeah, I was skinny until I quit smoking in my 30s.
But I wouldn't.
I'm glad I quit smoking.
I would not hazard a guess about that, without speaking with the young man. It certainly, particularly in children, can lead to, failure to thrive or to grow is one of the big indicators. But for a 20-year-old who can't gain weight, could be lots and lots of reasons.
Robert from Milburn, you're on the air. Robert, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is about what did people do over the millennia when bread was a staple of most people's diets?
They suffered, Bernadette?
They certainly did, but there are many parts of the world, for example, in Ireland, where the staple of the diet is potatoes. I mean, they do eat a lot of wheat products there as well, but they do have a very high rate of celiac disease, and many of those people did suffer, and they died early from lymphomas and other fatal illnesses.
Okay, well, you're going to have to do this very quickly, but I'm going to let Nicole talk for just a moment. You said that you disagree with Dean about whether the gluten-free foods that we have right now are just okay?
Yes, I do. Thank you for taking my call. I disagree really strongly, not just because I've written a gluten-free cookbook of my own, which I do think is very good.
There it is.
But it's not. I don't even have to mention the name of it. I just think it's very important that people understand that things have progressed tremendously. There are, I believe, 15 companies that have all-purpose gluten-free flour blends on the market today. With all due respect, I think that it's generally, for most people, not a good idea for them to start creating their own mix of flours.
Well, Nicole, I have to leave it there, unfortunately. My great thanks to all of you who've called in, to Chef Dean J. Livornia, and to nutritionist Bernadette Latson for making this edition of Please Explain so much fun.
Thank you, Leonard.
Join guest host Mike Pesca on Monday's show when he'll speak with the one and only Alice Cooper, who'll be discussing his latest album. Also, a sneak peek at a new 6-DVD set of Ernie Kovacs' work, plus a look at the previously untold story of one of tennis's most fierce rivalries between Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jessica Miller and William Miesmer. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week. Thank you.